topic I'm going to talk about this evening, again, just like I've so many talks around the world, and many of those talks you've already heard before because they get on the internet. And the Buddha never had that trouble when he was alive. He didn't have YouTube, so he could give the talk in many, many places, the same talk many times, but I can't get away with that because people are always listening to all over the place. And again, giving so many talks. This is what happens when you go traveling a lot. Look, sometimes it's a case I wake up in the morning, I don't know where I am. You look around, what country am I in this morning? And so I just come over from Malaysia and Singapore and Penang, and next week, another week or two, going to Sri Lanka, and goodness, I travel so much. And people do recognize me in the airport. I mean, this afternoon, they say, "You again." Of course, I'm very easy to pick out. I don't know why. It must be my smile. Is there something else about the way I look? That? But anyway, even though I do work very hard and I just travel around a lot and you always people come and ask you questions, I always manage to make sure I remember an important teaching of Buddhism. Always put happiness into whatever you're doing. And learning how to put happiness into life is one of the great teachings and secrets of Buddhism. And I know that sometimes religions think they should be more, just be so detached they hardly ever smile. The talk I gave last night in Singapore to about 1,000 or so people, the person who was doing the emceeing said, "Ajahn Brahm, please don't tell too many jokes. Don't talk about, you know, even mention the word sex. Because," he said, "we want you to look more holy." And I said, "Look, this is who I am." And sometimes the idea, when I heard that, what do you mean, holy? What's the idea of like a holy person? Some person who always sits here, never laughs, never smiles, never cracks a joke, who's always totally like, you know, are you really looking for a robot, some cyborg from outer space? Or are you looking for a human being? And sometimes I'd see some monks like that, and people who you really tried hard to get them to laugh. Eventually you managed to do it, because that's the nature of human beings. But when I saw that monks were miserable, in the early years when I was a lay Buddhist in London, that would really turn me off. You know, I thought, gee, do I really want to be like that? Because, you know, when any sort of teaching, we are sort of giving like a product here. Let's, you know, talk it in marketing terms. This is a product which is, you know, given here. You can't say it's on sale because it's all given for free in the Buddhist Society of West Australia and Nolamara on a Friday evening. This is like a product over here. And you want to actually make sure that coming here, spending your Friday evenings or your Saturday afternoons meditating here, you actually there's something here for you. And so when it's a product, it's not a case of advertising it, explaining it, sort of letting people know what it is and how it works, but you also want to see some end results. You want to see some people who have been practicing Buddhism or meditation for a while and checking them out and make sure they're really happy. I always remember one of our former presidents, Rachel. She actually wrote a little autobiography of her journey into Buddhism. She had panic disorders. She's a great woman and very competent and very successful, you know, independent woman, runs her own company. But every now and again, she'd have these great panic disorders. And that was really giving her whole life just a great sense of fear, because she never knew where the panic disorders would come. She'd be having a wonderful time, say, in the shopping mall, and suddenly this panic disorder would come in and she'd paralyze her. So she decided to learn some meditation to overcome her panic disorders. You know, this is many, many people come here on a Saturday afternoon or a Friday, and they're not Buddhists, they're not interested in spirituality or religion. They're actually sent here by their doctors, they're referred here. We don't bulk bill, we don't do any billing. And we but the people still come here anyway, and the doctors send them here, and even the dentists too. Some of those meditation books are in all the dentist surgeries in the local area. So they're doing this because they know it's going to create some sort of happiness, some peace. So when I was a young Buddhist, I actually wanted to see, okay, these people have been meditating a long time. Now, are they really happy? And with Rachel's story, she said she went to see the Armadale group for meditation, and she noticed that these monks were always smiling. She said it's in her autobiography. They're always kind of happy. And they're very lovely that last week you saw the smiling nuns as well. I know I think when I was a young man in Christianity, they had the singing nuns. We don't have singing nuns in Buddhism. We have the smiling nuns, the laughing nuns. And she was apparently very, very happy, and she told even more funny jokes than I have. Perhaps that's because that's only the first time she's given a talk here, and you haven't heard her jokes before. Unfortunately, that's not the same for me. But anyhow, but she said that she saw these monks, and they were always smiling and happy, and she thought at first, oh, this is just, you know, the face you put on for other people in public. So she decided to go to the monasteries and check these monks out, to see whether these monks are for real, whether we really are happy. And you know, she checked them out, and my goodness, it's not just one monk. All these monks she went to go and see actually were genuinely happy. And that really intrigued her. And she actually wrote in her book, whatever those monks were on, I wanted some of it. And that's actually why she really got into Buddhism. So... for me, anyway, the happiness principle is even more important than the theory and the philosophy. Yeah, you can come and listen to talks, and it's really inspiring philosophy. It may really give you an insight into the meaning of life, but so what if it doesn't take away your suffering and your pain and your misery and your guilt and your fears and worries? Yeah, it may sound good, but that really doesn't cut any ice. You may be able to explain that to your friends and philosophize, intellectualize, and get a PhD on it, but does that really help you? That's actually one of the first things which made me give up academia. Remember, I was from Cambridge University, and I actually met Nobel laureates. You know, people who are just incredibly intelligent. And I was really surprised. If you actually meet a Nobel laureate, yeah, they're intelligent, but my goodness, they're so stupid. In other words, they just don't know about life and about how being happy and how being engaging with people. There was that, Dennis would know this, because a couple of years ago we got Sir Roger Penrose to come over to Perth. That was the University of WA, Professor David Blair. He came over to Perth. And this is a guy, one of the greatest living physicists, the fellow who invented black holes. Now, I mean, that's big-time physics. You all know about black holes. You may not have much of a clue what they are, but, you know, he invented it, so he's Mr. Black Hole. And because of all my connections, you know, I actually got an invite to dinner. You know, I can't eat anything. But anyway, and I asked Dennis, our president, because he really likes astronomical things and physics things. And I remember just calling him up one evening and saying, hey, I've got this invitation to go to this dinner with Sir Roger Penrose. And, you know, when you get invited to dinner, you ask to bring your partner. I've got a part. I'm a monk, so I rang up Dennis, and he's very happy to go over there and meet sort of one of the stars of science. But, you know, with all great respect to, you know, Roger Penrose, he's an incredibly brilliant man. And his intelligent, he's just way off the scale of, you know, if you do an IQ test on him. But, as a person, you know, you couldn't hold a conversation with him. You know, he was not really engaging. And I thought that's another case of a person. He's not really happy in the sense of, you know, being able to enjoy life or being able to enjoy the different situations. I think he really is happy in front of a blackboard, you know, giving a lecture. And he really is happy just on a piece of paper with all these incredible mystic symbols called mathematics. But there's something missing there. And that's actually what I saw in these great sort of scientists I hang out with in Cambridge, that there was something missing. They didn't have the real oomph, the happiness there. And I saw that in some monks as well. They didn't have the oomph and the happiness. So eventually, obviously, you found really monks who were happy, and they really inspired you because you wanted a secret of happiness. And of course, one of the secrets of happiness is actually to put happiness into whatever you have to do. And that's actually one of my secrets, because sometimes I should be totally wiped out, so totally tired tonight. If I gave you a list of all the things I've done since the last time I gave a talk here, which was 2 weeks ago, and I haven't stopped, hardly slept, and I should be totally wiped out. And here you are, sort of talking and going to lead a party this evening. And I learned something from those early years of being a Buddhist. That, yeah, you know, you have to do these things in life, so why not put your energy into it, enjoy it, make it fun, make it interesting. And that has been sort of the whole sort of story of my life. Even in meditation, I just make it fun. I put energy into it. I put joy into it. And one of the things which, you know, this is actually where it really comes from, is to realize that that joy which you are giving, that energy which you're giving into life, is actually where you engage your mind totally with the present moment. You really put yourself into this moment. Because every time you fear and worry what's going to happen next, every time you linger on, oh gee, what did I do in the past? What did they do in the past? Why did they do this to me? All of those sorts of ideas just take away your happiness. You're destroying this natural state of the mind to be energetic and happy. You're wasting energy with all the negativity which one gives to the past and the future. Now, we all know about negativity to the past. And you know, psychology deals with that every day. You know, about the, you know, what did I do to whom and why did they do it? And we, you know, we call that forgiveness, letting go of the past, letting go of your anger. We all know how to do that. I talk about that every other week. And it's only here every other week. That's why I talk about it all the time. But the other thing is the negativity which we have to the future. Why on earth do we worry so much about the future? Look, sort of, this evening we have Ajahn Brahm's party. I always do an event, something different every time. Last year it was like, who wants to be a millionaire, but changed to who wants to be a merit millionaire. And I just thought about that on the plane coming over here. And this evening, what we're going to be doing is, so you think you're a Buddhist. And that was only, I think it was yesterday morning. Just finished the retreat in Penang. And I thought, oh my goodness, in a day's time, I've got to come up with something. And you just don't worry about these things, you just let it happen. And you always come up with something. Because you know how to put this energy and not worry about the future. You find if you worry about your future, if you just plan A, plan B, plan C, you get so tight in the future, you can't be creative. And what else is the future than just the expression of your own creativity? Because you actually create your futures. Again, going to Malaysia and Singapore, where I spent the last couple of weeks, and many sort of people from that area, or you know, their genes came from that area, even though they've been Australianized. I don't know how many of those people go to fortune tellers. And even next week going to Sri Lanka, I mean, many of you go to Kataragama, the great fortune-telling place. What the heck do you do that for? Why are you so concerned about the future? And every now and again, those fortune tellers come and tell you bad news. 2011 is going to be a bad year for you, they say. And of course, what happens next? They come and see me. Can you do something about this, Ajahn Brahm? 2011 is going to be a bad year. I'm sure you could do something. I'm so worried, so concerned. And is it really going to happen? And even actually last night, it was very, very sad. This girl came out to me, you know, pretty girl, 25, 26, crying, crying, crying. And because her boyfriend was about to get engaged to her, and so she was Chinese, boyfriend Chinese, was about to get engaged, and her in-laws-to-be, her boyfriend's, her lover's parents insisted they go to the fortune teller to see whether they were compatible. And the fortune teller said they were not compatible. So the boy said, even though I love you, it's probably best I don't marry you. And oh, that was just so stupid and so sad. So, you know, when they believe things like that, because that doesn't happen. You know, you get an arranged marriage and it happens. Sometimes it doesn't matter. I saw this joke the other day. What's the difference between an arranged marriage and when you choose your partner through love? It's the same difference between a murder and a suicide. One, other people do it to you, and the other one you do yourself. If you choose your partner, you do it yourself. That's called suicide. When your when your parents do it to you, that's called murder. That's only a joke, of course. Please don't say that I'm anti-marriage. But I don't know why when people give me all these jokes, I don't make them up. Someone gives these to me, and they're all about marriage and relationship. Half the jokes are about marriage and relationships. The other one's about mothers-in-law. But there must be some truth to it there somewhere. It doesn't have to be like that. But anyway, when I saw that couple, and my goodness, look, this is really, really wrong. Now, you create your future. And understand, this is one of the fundamental parts of Buddhism. There is no such thing as destiny. The future is totally uncertain, which gives you the knowledge that you are creating the future in every moment of your lives. And it's because you are the creator, you are creating your future. It gives you a huge amount of responsibility. You can't blame anybody, but it gives you total freedom to craft your future. You can do anything. You can create whatever you wish to create. If you have the understanding that there's no limitations put on you by destiny, by fate or whatever. And understanding that is wonderful. So I told this lady, look, you can create your future together. I don't care what that fortune teller says. Buddhist monks are much more powerful than fortune tellers. They don't realize the power of these Buddhist monks. You know, we have got great powers. And I remember this story, I don't know the last time I told you this, but I remember this once when I was staying with my mother in London, in her apartment, and she was cooking me my one meal of the day. Now for monks, if you only eat once a day, it's quite important. And I didn't want her to mess up my lunch. Okay, it was selfish. But then when the doorbell rang, I said, Mum, you carry on cooking. I'll look after the person at the door. So the monks are laughing at that because they can understand it. Maybe you can't, because if it goes wrong, if you miss your lunch, you can get afternoon tea, you can get dinner, you can get takeaway any time. But we've got one shot at it every day. And if we stuff up, that's it. So anyway, I answered the door, and this they call them gypsy ladies. And these were like itinerant people in England who would go from door to door selling trinkets. It's how they made a living. And this woman said, I'm a gypsy, I've come to sell lucky gypsy trinkets. And I was very polite. You know, I said, no thank you, ma'am. No, we don't need any. And then she gave her marketing spiel. This is what they do to get the sale. They say, if you do not buy my trinket, I will put a gypsy curse on you. And you wouldn't believe how many stupid people in London believe that, and they buy it just in case. Because we're so superstitious. But of course, I am the last person to be superstitious. So when she tried that on me, and I'm also very cheeky, and I'm also just stand up for things. So when she said that to me, I'll put a gypsy curse on you if you don't buy a trinket. I just stood up, I was just really raised my body in my monk's robe and said, can't you see, I am a Buddhist monk. Madam, my curses are much stronger than yours. That's about what I said. And that poor woman, that was a terrible thing I did to her, because her jaw dropped, her face went white, she turned around and ran. I really scared her. And of course, there's no such thing as Buddhist curses, we wouldn't do that anyway. The only curse we have on anybody is may you be happy and well. That's a Buddhist curse. The only one we've got. And that's pretty strong too. But anyway, I don't know where I was going with that anyway, with the gypsies women and just making curses. Oh yeah, this predicting your future. You can totally create whatever you want. And okay, so that's been my life here. We come here to Perth, 27 years ago. Let's create something beautiful and wonderful. And let's not just be stuck about fate or what we can do, what we can't do. Just the sky's the limit in many, many ways. So when you know you can create things, it really helps to know that you can create happiness. And just this life which you have, this year, the next year, this is empty, empty canvas, and you can paint it black and white and greys, or you can put these incredibly wonderful, beautiful colors on, the bright colors, the happy colors. And when you know you can do that, you can create happiness, sometimes people say, why? And then one of the reasons why is because it makes life far easier. One of the first times I heard this, I was in Cambridge, going back to my university days. You always give personal examples, but one of the things I got caught up doing in Cambridge was like rowing in these eights. You know, I was a fit young man when I was young. Now look what you've done to me. But I was still pretty fit and healthy. But so I got caught up in this rowing club for my local college. And that was really hard work sometimes, you know, in a race. You know, that's why they have, you know, pulling these oars machines, you know, in the gyms to keep you healthy. It's very, very hard exercise. But going through this race, and it was a very, very tough race. And, you know, you just keep on just almost catching up to the other boat, but not quite. And so you're really working hard. Everyone is just pulling every sort of thing out of the hat to try and push those oars even faster. And then I remember hearing the coach. They always have these guys on the towpath with these megaphones. And he was shouting at me. He was saying, you know, my name. And he said, you are making such an ugly face. Smile, for goodness sake. And yeah, you do that when you're really struggling and striving and just pushing through pain as you try and pull that oar faster and with more force. You know, you tend to put on an ugly face. You look at sort of someone really struggling and they look so ugly, they look like monsters. And he said, try smiling. Now, I was always up to suggestions. If somebody suggested something to me, I'd try it just to see. I got into a lot of trouble that way, but not on this occasion. So, I tried it, and it was amazing. I remember that. As soon as I started smiling, the oar was easier to pull, and I had more energy. And that was the first occasion I understood. And I thanked the coach afterwards. I said, that was the first occasion I understood. When you put a bit of happiness and joy into what you're doing, you can do more. You're more powerful. And it's not just with rowing or sport. It's with everything else you do in your life. You get more energy, more power, more success. And so that's one of the reasons why, that, you know, if you're bricklaying, if you're pushing wheelbarrows. I was, that's a wheelbarrow story. It's a great story. I haven't told that for years. About that occasion, Ajahn Chah teaching us, you know, how to sort of put happiness and energy into our life. He was building his main hall. Now, I should mention that, you know, next year, I'm sure you're going to hear this a lot, the nuns are going to build their next hall soon. So, you know, be prepared for that. That's coming soon, next year. And he was very poor in his monastery. I don't know if he was very poor, he just wanted to exploit us. Because he had all this free work power, the young monks like me. These young guys, fit, healthy, young. So he got us out to help work because he had machines to build this big mound, and on top of the mound was going to be his main hall. You know, still there today. It's the ordination hall, like the Holy of Holies in Ajahn Chah's monastery. But he had all this pile of earth left. Huge pile of earth. And so he asked the monks, after our one meal a day, which, you know, finished pretty early, and about 9 o'clock, 9:30, we're finished. Usually we go back to meditate for the rest of the day. But he called us all up and said, look, we've got this big pile of earth. It needs to be moved. And I want you to move it over there. And he pointed to us. Here's the wheelbarrows, here's the spades. I know that was really hard work. You're pushing those wheelbarrows, shoveling the earth in it from now 9:30 in the morning. And we'd usually go into 7 p.m., 8 p.m., sometimes 9 p.m. with kerosene lanterns to show the way. And just on one meal a day, nothing, no lunch break or tea break. And it was really, really hard work. And that was like in the hot jungles, you know, in mosquitoes biting you all the time, dirty. But, you know, you had camaraderie. And when you're all doing it together, you know, you can do it. It took us 3 days. And at the end of the third day, when we finished, you know, I really thought, okay, now tomorrow I can have a rest after lunch. I really need to rest. And I'm going to wash my robes and I'm going to do some meditation. I've been working very hard. I'm very happy I've helped my teacher. Now I can rest. But that night, Ajahn Chah went off to another monastery. And that morning after he left, the second monk, he's now the abbot, Ajahn Liam, he came and he brought all the monks together and he said, you know, I've been thinking, where you put that earth, it's not the right place. And he said, you know, it doesn't look good. And he had a point. And he said, actually, you have a point there. So he said, I want you to move it. And so we thought, oh no, another 3 days. So another 3 days we all worked, pushing his heavy wheelbarrows from 9:30 to 6, 7, 8 o'clock at night, sweating, dirty, bitten by mosquitoes, with no meditation, really feeling tired, really dirty bodies, and you had to wash, but still the sweating made you feel really dirty all day, and dirty robes. But we finally finished. 6 days of hard work. And those of you who haven't heard the story, what happened next? That night Ajahn Chah came back. The following morning, after about 1 minute of the day, he called all the monks together. And he said, I told you to put that pile of earth over here. You put it over there. Move it back to where I told you. And at that point, I lost my faith. Because you didn't see Ajahn Chah or Ajahn Liam pushing those wheelbarrows. People like me had to push those wheelbarrows. They were, you know, senior monks. They would sit under their huts and they'd have nice cups of tea and talk to people. And I think this is really unfair. Now, anyway, can't they decide where they want this stupid part of earth anyway? And I never became a monk to be a laborer, to be exploited like this. That's not what I became a Buddhist for. I became a Buddhist to become enlightened, to meditate, and just to have a peaceful life. And there I am, pushing these heavy barrows of earth through the mosquito-ridden jungles in a hot climate on 1 meal a day. This is not good enough. This is unfair. And so, like many Westerners would, I was born in England, Australians do the same. I don't know if the Sri Lankans do this, but I'm sure you do. I'm sure there are some Sri Lankan swear words, because I certainly started using some English ones. And even though the Thai monks couldn't understand what I was saying, they could see by the body language I was one unhappy monk. And that was when one of the monks came to see me. And they said something, again, these one-liners, this wasn't from Ajahn Chah, this was another monk, I forget who it was. But, sadhu, 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 you changed my life again. What he said was, Brahma Wangsa, that's my full name, pushing the wheelbarrows is easy. Thinking about it is the hard part. Pushing is easy. Thinking is the hard part. And my goodness, how true that was. I got it in one. And I stopped thinking about pushing the wheelbarrows. I stopped complaining, stopped getting angry. I know they became much lighter. They became so easy to push. And 3 days went past so happily. And how many of you have done that in your life? You've got some big project on, some great task to achieve, and it's almost impossible, and sometimes you complain, you have to work on the weekends, you have to do this and do that. Thinking about it is the hard part. Doing it is very easy. Thinking about life is almost impossible, it drives you crazy. But living it is actually quite easy when you stop thinking and complaining and moaning. So putting happiness into life is not complaining about life. Yeah, you're going to have a hard time. Yeah, you're exploited. I'm exploited. I go to KL, they squeeze every last drop out of me. And then I go to Penang, and then they squeeze more drops out of me. Then I go to Singapore, and they squeeze the last drops out of me. And then you come here, and they squeeze drops out of me again. But you know, there's always more drops. And I never complain. Because no one listens anyway. No, you don't complain. Because if I complain, then I'm creating unhappiness for myself. So I learn how to put happiness in. Just like that coach says. Yeah, you've got to pull those oars of life. But why not smile when you're doing it? And bring happiness into your life. Then you find life doesn't hurt. Then you find you have more energy. Then you find you are more successful. Then you find you're actually helping other people find their happiness in life, because you're creating the world. Yeah, the world, you have to work, you have to talk, you have to push wheelbarrows in life, you have to do things which are very uncomfortable, but you have to do those things anyway. Your part of creation is putting that joy into that life, putting that creativity in that life. And when you put that joy and creativity into whatever you're doing, life becomes so easy. And even the unpleasant parts of life. Well, that other little story which I wrote in Open the Door of my Heart. The first time I was in Thailand, a young monk, I've got lots of these young Thai monk stories because, again, they really influenced the rest of my life. what was happening to us there. We would visit monastery to monastery for these big celebrations sometimes, or festivals. And sometimes it was a bit of an outing, you know, to go visit another monastery. Staying in your own monastery for such a long time, yeah, it was fun, it was peaceful. You know, it's nice to go and visit another monastery and see some of your mates and see, you know, how another monastery did things. But this was northeast Thailand 37 years ago. There were hardly any paved roads, all dirt roads. And being in the tropics, when the rain fell, it really fell. And when it fell, all those nice roads got potholes. The rain washed, you know, some of the tracks away, so it was bumpy and slippery, and again, some of these really big potholes. And we would actually be transported just like cattle in a truck. The senior monks would sit in the front in the cab, and the junior monks like me, we'd be in the tray in the back. They put benches in those trays, and they put a metal frame over that back with a canvas stretched over it to protect you from the rain. The trouble was, in those days, most Thai people were very small. To save money, that canvas, frame on the back carrying the canvas was actually quite low. And I was a Westerner who was much taller. So whenever that truck hit a pothole, the truck went down and I went up and I hit my head on those metal railings. And my goodness, that hurt. That might be okay for you because you've got what we call padding. You've got hair like a shock absorber if somebody hits you on the head. Buddhist monks, we've got nothing to protect us. Crack, bang. And that really hurt. So I was a new monk, fresh out of, you know, Europe. And again, what do you do when you crack your head? What do you do when you hit your finger with a hammer or something goes wrong? You know, you say the S-H-I-T word, or you say even of a worse word like that. You know, that's our culture, isn't it? When it hurts, you swear. So that's what I did. But what the Thai monks did, because sometimes those holes were so deep, even they hit their head. You know what? They laughed. When they hit their head, they burst out laughing. Now that was really weird. And I couldn't sort of wonder what on earth was going on there. So I started contemplating it. These Thai monks, when they hit their head, they laugh. And I swear, and I figured it out, those Thai monks have been living in this place longer than I have. They must have hit their head so many more times. They were brain damaged. That's why they laugh. How else could you explain laughing when you hit your head? Brain damage. But then I thought, that doesn't really make sense, because I know those monks, and they're not brain damaged. They're very wise and happy people. And then I realized the only way I'll find out is actually to try it myself. So I made a resolution. The next time that truck goes down and I crack my head on those metal railings, the next time that happens, I'll try laughing instead of swearing. You know what I found out? If you crack your head and you laugh, it hurts much less. It does, you know. If you don't believe me, ask the person sitting next to you to hit you in the head twice. First time swear, next time laugh. And do an experiment, being scientific. You know, I told that story in Singapore once, and they said, please don't tell that story again. Because they said, we'll get sued. You encourage people to hit each other on the head. So that's only please don't do that, okay? Otherwise the Buddhist Society of West Australia will get sued if you cause brain damage to the person sitting next to you. So, but what we did find, even in the painful situations of life, and we all have to undergo those suffering experiences in life, the times when you are sick, the times when you got cancer, the times when you have to go to the dentist. I tell you, I love going to the dentist. Look, wherever I go, especially overseas, people always ask me questions, even in the airport, on the plane. People know me now, even on the plane. I told you the last time, coming back from KL on my previous trip, somebody saw me on the aircraft and said, are you Ajahn Brahm? Yes. and they sat next to me and had free counseling. They wouldn't let me go for the period of the flight. This time on the flight, I forget from where, but this guy, that's from Penang to Singapore. This Indonesian recognized me. You, the author of that book, Open the Door of Your Heart? Yes. So he started asking me questions. I can't get away from it. So you know what it's like sometimes? Oh, leave me alone. Can't you give me some peace? And I can't do that anymore. So instead of getting upset and angry, I have fun with it now. And of course, the classic story, which was that time I was coming back from Los Angeles and teaching in the United States, getting really tired. It's a really heavy flight, and 20 hours or something, and that was actually via Singapore. And I just felt really so tired. And unfortunately, at the airport, even inside the airport, many Singaporeans know me, so they're actually waiting at the gate inside to take me to have a cup of tea and ask questions on meditation. And I thought, oh, come on, guys, give me a break. You know, I'm really tired. I'm not just some sort of machine. You ask me a question, ask me counseling, ask me all the questions about your marriage and your family. Look, please understand, I've never been married. What do I know about all these things? But nevertheless, they keep on asking me. Ask me meditation questions, but always the same questions. I get very tired anyway. And that was the time I thought, I've got to escape. I can't take this any longer. So I went to the toilet. And you'd think, wouldn't you think that, you know, you could escape in the loo? I can't. As soon as I went into the toilet attendant recognized me. It's true. He said, are you Ajahn Brahm? I said, yes. Can I ask some questions on meditation? Oh, God. That actually happened. So, look, it's like being hit on the head. You can either swear or you can laugh at it. And I prefer to laugh at it. And when you laugh at life, you put happiness into it. Life doesn't hurt so much. It was actually funny. And so whenever, any time things go wrong like that, instead of complaining or getting upset, getting angry, feeling guilty or whatever, I find that's wonderful that I can actually, that's life. And life is really just stupid. People make these stupid mistakes and they do really crazy things. And I think that makes life very funny. So when people do stupid things, you've got a choice to swear and get negative or to laugh and have fun. So the next time you find your partner has been sleeping with someone else, don't complain, laugh. That's hilarious. That poor woman, does she really know what she's up for? The next time you get divorced, have fun, enjoy. Wow, I'm free. Laugh. And you must, and this is no joke actually, that is it? Well, these are jokes, laughing, but it's the real jokes. That again, just coming back from Kuala Lumpur, the Dr. K. Sri Dharmananda, he's got some books out there. Why Worry is one of the books, or Questions on Buddha. I forget what all the books he's written. We have them on sale over there. Please read them. He was a very wise monk. And we know he was a wise monk. It's not just words, because when his oncologist told him that his cancer was terminal for the first time, and he died a couple of years ago, when he was told he was terminally ill, he burst out laughing. And his oncologist could not believe that, and so he wrote this in his book. This is the first and only time any of my patients has actually laughed when they were told they were going to die. And that's brilliant. That shows the guy knew what he was talking about. It wasn't just words. He actually did it. But you're going to die anyway. You know, why complain about it? Is anyone going to listen? Like complaining, is that going to make you alive? Is that going to get rid of your terminal illness? So if you go to the doctor and they say you're terminally ill, what a great story that is. Laugh. Number one, it won't lessen your life, laughing. And actually laughing might actually get rid of that cancer for you. It's amazing just how positive energy gets rid of these things. Every now and again, you know, you meet people. I've met a couple of people over in Malaysia who actually cured their cancers. And they always say meditation helped. I told this story of, because people were complaining in the meditation retreat I was teaching over there, that others were making noise. You know, when people are trying to meditate, you don't want them to make noise. And so I told them the story. This one retreat I did in Sydney many years ago, there was a fellow in the retreat making this terrible noise every time he meditated. And I know after a couple of days of that, that was really sort of driving people up the wall. So someone wrote in the question time, a piece of paper, Ajahn Brahm, can you please ask people to breathe quietly? That's a stupid question to ask because, you know, you do if you could. If you don't, it means you can't. And so I announced that man is suffering from nasal cancer. He's told his disease is terminal. He's tried chemotherapy, radiation therapy, everything. This is his last throw of the dice. He feels he's going to die, and out of desperation, he's come on this retreat. He can't breathe quietly. That's the best he can do. And as soon as I said that, people realized how they judged so harshly. They didn't really know why. When they knew why, there was no more complaints. They had this great sense of compassion and sympathy for this guy, knowing this was probably the last few weeks of his life. And you know what happened at the end of the retreat? He actually came to see me. It was like the last interview. And he said an amazing thing happened just that morning. He was meditating. That was normal because his nasal passages were totally blocked with this tumor. And I always remember the way he said it. He said it was a pop. And he could breathe. But it only lasted a minute or two. And then the tumor closed up. But that, I always remember the word, it's like a pop. As somehow or other the tumor got smaller and air could go up through his nose. And of course, it's no imagination. Sometimes you can imagine tumors in your breast or other parts of your body. But here, you know, you could tell it had actually gone smaller without any x-rays because air could go up and down through his nose. He said it was the most amazing thing. But it had closed about shortly afterwards. And I went away from that retreat saying, I wish that guy had started meditation earlier. I thought it was far too late. I thought, you know, he'd left it just, you know, to a point where it can't really do any good. But 4 or 5 years later, I was teaching a meditation group in Sydney, and this guy comes up to me and said, do you remember me? Now, you might remember me because I do look strange, but you guys all look the same. So, you know, in a suit and the hair and stuff like that. So I said, well, I don't remember you. Who the hell are you? And he said, I am that guy who breathed so loudly at that retreat. And he said, from that time on, my meditation got rid of my cancer. I can breathe normally, full remission, didn't need to have any surgery. He just vanished. He said, I'm spending the rest of my life teaching meditation for others in similar situations. He said, I saw you were coming. I just want to come up and just to check in with you to say what happened. Thank you so much for teaching me that meditation. That's a beautiful little story there. You know, this, why did that happen? Because, again, the meditation is just positive, happy. If you laugh at things, you smile at things, it's much easier. And for those of you really into meditation, well, even when I opened my eyes just at 8 o'clock to look at you guys, how many of you were smiling? Hardly any of you. No wonder your meditation is not taking off. For goodness sake, if you smile when you're meditating, just like rowing a boat is actually much easier. You can actually get more energy, you get deeper, you're actually putting happiness into meditation. And you know that sometimes, fortunately, that, you know, all the teachers, the monks and nuns who come here, you know, that we actually vet them first of all to make sure they've got good quality control before we let them on you, so they're pretty good monks. But you know, there are some monks and nuns who say, oh no, if you get happy, you get attached to it. I thought, oh my goodness, what are you guys talking to? How long have you been a monk? Have you ever read what the Buddha said? You're supposed to be happy in meditation. Buddhism is supposed to lessen suffering. And if you lessen suffering, isn't that mean you're happier and happier and happier? You're supposed to get happier. So if you get happier, it's not as if you're getting attached to anything. You're letting go of suffering. So please go for it. The happier the better. So put happiness into that meditation. And for those of you who say, oh, Ajahn Brahm, you know, those traditional Buddhists, oh, you just talk, you know, from your own experience or from your own ideas. One of the sutras actually the teachings of the Buddha recorded for posterity in these books called the Tipitaka or the Chinese Argamas. Is one of these suttas, one of my favorite ones. It's in the Majjhima Nikaya. It's called the Dhammacaitiya Sutta. It's translated in the English version as Monuments to the Dhamma. And in this sutta, there was this king, this great supporter of the Buddha called King Pasenadi. He was about to die and he came to see the Buddha the last time in his monastery. And when he came there, he went into the Buddha's hut and he bowed down to his feet and started kissing his feet. And the Buddha said, look, you're a king, what are you up to? And he said, just look, I've known you all my life and I love you so much. It was an expression of like love to his teacher. You've helped me so much. And I just love coming into this monastery. And the Buddha said, and this was the important part of the sutta, relevant to this evening's talk, why do you like coming to monastery? And he said, because whenever I come into this monastery, unlike all the other places I visit, all the monks and the nuns are always smiling and happy. And that makes me happy. That's why I like coming here. And that to me gave me a window of what it was like in the monasteries in the time of the Buddha. That the monks and nuns were smiling. And that's why people like to come. Now any of you go to monasteries and people aren't smiling, there's something wrong there. It also means your meditation's not going well, that you won't get good meditation, you're pulling that boat and you're making an ugly face. So, learning how to put fun and joy into your meditation, into life, no matter what you're doing, this is where you can create the happiness in your future. And again, that couple last night, not the couple, I told, bring your boy to me and I'll give him another prediction. And my predictions are much better than that fortune teller you went to see. Bring your in-laws as well, because they might respect me. That if you really want to work together, you two, if you want to make a life together, you can. You already love each other. The boy said he actually loved that girl, but it was only because he believed the fortune, it would all go wrong, he didn't want to give it a chance. So no, give it a chance, make it work. You can make anything work, if you really put your energy into it. All those projects which we've done here, whether this place over here, our monastery in Serpentine, our nuns' monastery, our retreat center. I don't know, many people, Dennis will know this, many people when we started these ideas, oh, it won't work, it can't work, it's the wrong thing to do, but you put energy into it. You make it work. That's actually how we actually make things happen. That's why we've got to. What I say is a great Buddhist society over here, great facilities, much better than anywhere else in Australia. I don't mind saying that, probably many places in the world. You can check it out for yourself. Why? Because we make it happen, we put happiness into whatever we're doing, we bring that joy, we stop cursing when things go wrong, we keep going forward when you're pushing that wheelbarrow, which is your life, which is whatever you want to achieve in this world, when you're pushing that wheelbarrow. Remember, thinking about it is a difficult part. Complaining makes it really, really heavy. Don't think about it, smile at it, and all your wheelbarrows in life will be light ones. That's the talk for this evening. 50 minutes has gone past already, and I wanted to keep it brief. It's amazing how fast time goes, and I'm really exhausted. And I'm beginning this talk, I haven't got a clue what I was going to talk about. And here I pushed this barrow of this talk and it was just so light and easy. Why? Because I put fun into it and I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you for listening. Now was that putting fun and joy into sadhu, sadhu, sadhu? It was not at all. You haven't been listening to anything. Try again. Put fun and joy. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Now what happened? You see you got joy and happiness? So easy to do. Okay, now, hopefully I'll get some questions this evening. It's very rare to get questions. So please, I wasn't here for Christmas. Please give me a Christmas gift of a question. Oh, come on. Actually, where did that one go? Why are you thinking of a question? Oops, sorry. Ooh, I'll leave it alone. I do. While you're thinking of a question, just do it the other way around. I remember, because I wasn't here on Christmas, that was Sister Naroda gave the talk. I did. Is this work? Is this better than doing that? No, it doesn't. Okay. Oh, that's what happens. I just shouldn't breathe. Okay, I'll put it on there. When, because I was away at Christmas, I did have like a story about the four stages of life in terms of Santa Claus. That when you're very young, you believe in Santa Claus. When you sort of, you know, become sort of a teenager, you don't believe in Santa Claus. When you become an adult in your 20s and 30s, then you actually you dress up as Santa Claus. And later on in life, you look like Santa Claus. The four stages of life. Any questions anyone's got? Ah, okay, anyway. Can't see any hands go up.